of meat. In myth, confrontations between humans and beasts often occur at a potential kill site and leave the predator deprived of its meal. Hesione and Andromeda were not devoured by the monsters they were intended for, but rather were rescued by the heroes, Heracles and Perseus respectively, they would end up marrying. In Thespiae, the practice of choosing a young man by lot every year to be fed to the dragon ended when the male lover of one chosen victim volunteered to be sacrificed in his stead, then killed the beast. In all these cases, love triumphs over fear, the sacrifice is subverted, and a potential meal becomes a mate. How exactly did our hominid ancestors confront, and with luck, repel predator animals? Most likely hominid resistance predated any effective weapons technology, and, as in the case of other social animals, invoked the strength of numbers. Birds and non-human primates will often drive away dangerous intruders by mobbing them. All members of the group, male and female, mature and immature, close ranks and advance on the intruder, making the most threatening noises and gestures at their command. Modern humans, such as unarmed campers confronting a bear, tend almost instinctively to do the same, banding together, shouting and banging on pots and pans. Summarizing the ways non-human primates respond to predators, anthropologists Lisa Rose and Fiona Marshall write, "Once potential predators have been detected, the reactions of extant primates are often coordinated and aggressive. Individuals typically respond rapidly to the alarm calls of others. In chimpanzees and capuchins, dispersed groups will quickly coalesce and join in aggressive displays. Baboons mob and chase cheetahs or jackals, and will attack and fight even lions or leopards. Whenever Tay Forest chimpanzees notice the presence of a leopard, they search for it and chase it away cooperatively." Rose and Marshall suggest that these cases of collective defense among non-human primates may well be a model for the defensive behavior of hominids, who would have responded similarly to the risk of carnivore predation by intensifying cooperative behaviors, perhaps using branches or stones as simple defensive weapons. The behaviors required for collective resistance may have helped establish the rudiments of hominid culture. In his most recent book, historian William H. McNeill addresses the human propensity for keeping together in time, as through group dancing and military drilling, and suggests that it can be traced to the primordial sociality of the hominid band confronting a wild animal. Possibly the invention of music, as well as the nearly universal practice of dancing, owes much to the exigencies of anti-predator defense. In creatures that have some chance of succeeding at group resistance, the perception of danger may trigger powerful feelings of group solidarity. Not in everyone, of course. There are always those who choose to hide or climb a tree. But chimpanzees, for example, may become highly aroused at the mere sight of a killing, screaming loudly as they watch the action and running about and throwing their arms around one another. Male colobus monkeys, sweetly enough, prepare for group resistance to a predator by running to one another and embracing for reassurance. And we know from quite recent human experience that nothing pulls a group or a nation together like the appearance of an enemy or external threat. It is a shame, perhaps, that hatred and mortal fear seem to draw us together so much more reliably than love and camaraderie. But as any demagogue knows, a crowd is most likely to bond into a purposeful entity when it has an enemy to face. Millennia of terror seem to have left us with another Darwinian algorithm, that in the face of danger, we need to cleave together, becoming a new many-headed creature, larger than our individual selves. The final stage of the rebellion occurs when humans learn to hunt and kill for themselves, game animals, and even at times, the predator beasts themselves. hunting in the early stages may have been, like early forms of defense, an activity involving the entire group, females and children included. The stratagem of mobbing would have lent itself to such hunting techniques as driving animals over cliffs to their death, beating the underbrush to force the game out from cover, or simply overwhelming a cornered animal. Our prime tutors in the subject of hunting were probably not the big cats, which usually hunt alone, but the wolves and wild dogs, which know how to work in a pack. But it is through hunting that humans come to imitate individual beasts, as well as the behavior of packs. Stones, which have been pounded until they acquire an edge, as well as sticks, which have been brought to a point with sharpened stones, become the human equivalent of the teeth and the claws of the beast. Thousands of years later, with the subjugation of the horse and the emergence of the mounted archer, humans finally achieved both the speed and the deadliness of a leopard or lion. Perhaps the fearful symmetry Blake saw in the face of the tiger was his own human face, reflected back. Reenacting the rebellion. The transformation from prey to predator, in which the weak rise up against the strong, is the central story in the early human narrative. Some residual anxiety seems to draw us back to it again and again. We recount it as myth and reenact it in ritual, as if we could never be sufficiently assured that it has indeed occurred. In folk tales, lions are defeated by foxes, wolves outwitted by clever monkeys, and in general, small, tiny, and physically weak animals or birds are shown as wiser than the big animals or birds, and essentially victorious in their tasks and struggles against them. In religious narratives and rituals, few themes are as ubiquitous as that of the potential victim who is resurrected or otherwise upgraded to the status of victor. The British anthropologist Maurice Bloch concludes, remarkably enough, that this is, in fact, what religion is about. The dramatic transformation of prey into hunter underlies in different forms the practices which can easily be subsumed under the English word religion. Origin myths are one way in which the transformation story is retold. Mircea Eliade found that an origin myth commonly tells of a primordial animal who killed human beings in order to resuscitate them. In the end, the animal was itself killed, and this event, which took place in the beginning, is ritually reiterated. The animal might have been a python or a monster. It may have eaten humans and regurgitated them. It might have been killed because it stopped regurgitating its victims, or did not regurgitate enough of them. In any case, a supernatural being had attempted to renew men by killing them, in order to bring them to life again, changed. For one reason or another, men slew this supreme being, but they later celebrated secret rites inspired by this drama. More precisely, the violent death of the supreme being became the central mystery. Just as the entire species had to undergo the prey-to-predator transformation long ago in the Paleolithic past, so does each child undergo a version of it in the course of growing up. We start as helpless infants, weighing less than 1/10 as much as adults and unable to support even that tiny weight on our infant limbs. We start, in other words, as potential prey, and remain at the mercy of giants for many years before we find our way, through learning and growth, to a more commanding status. Most cultures have marked the transition from potential prey to potential predator with initiation rites, and these often seem to be quite vivid and literal reenactments of the primal encounter with a man-eating predator beast. Consider the initiation rites practiced by the Orkaiva people of New Guinea. The children to be initiated, both boys and girls, are first menaced by masked adults leaping out from the bush. The intruders, who are supposed to be spirits, chase the children, shouting "bite, bite, bite" at them, and herd them onto a platform of the kind usually used for the slaughter of pigs. The terrified children are then covered in a blinding cape and taken to an isolated hut in the bush, where they undergo various ordeals and are inducted into tribal secrets. Not infrequently, the anthropologists tell us, some of the children die during the course of these ordeals. Finally, the surviving initiates return to the village, dressed in masks and feathers, like the spirits who first menaced them, and participate in a pig hunt. They return, Block reports, not as prey, but as hunters of pigs, shouting the same formula which had been addressed to them, bite, bite, bite. Australia and New Guinea lack large terrestrial carnivores, and in these places it is spirits, monsters, deities, or medicine men who frighten the initiates in the first phase of the ritual. But these also usually turn out to be man-eating creatures, hungry for human flesh. In the Indo-Tibetan rite of Tetud, for example, a sword-wielding goddess attacks the novice, decapitates him, and cuts his body to pieces. Then he sees demons and wild beasts fling themselves on the fragments of his flesh and devour them. In places where dangerous animals are common, they or their surrogates play a central role in rites of initiation. Among the Nootka, Kwakiutl, and Quileute peoples of the Pacific Northwest, it is wolves, men in wolf masks, who menace the initiates, abduct them into the forest, subject them to ordeals, including ritual scarring, which may imitate the effect of claws, and finally introduce them to the secrets of the wolf cult. Among the Luseño and Degaño Indians of California, the boys being initiated are threatened with death from attacks by pumas, bears, ravens, tarantulas, and rattlesnakes. In some African ceremonies, the central ordeal of male initiation is circumcision, which is performed by men dressed in lion and leopard skins. As Eliade writes, they incarnate the divinities in animal form, who in mythical times first performed initiatory murder. But soon afterward, the novices are themselves dressed in leopard or lion skins. In at least some instances, females too undergo violent initiatory encounters with beasts. In the rites of initiation into the African Female Secret Society of the Pongwe, one of the leaders symbolizes a leopard who attacks, kills, and eats the novices. Finally, the other leader kills the leopard and frees the novices from the belly of the first one. This ritual motif is bound up with hunting and, consequently, properly belongs to men. Eliade comments huffily. Northern European myths emphasize the need to become a beast in order to become a warrior. The initiate became a dreaded warrior in the measure in which he behaved like a beast of prey. He wore a wolf skin and behaved wolfishly, or he donned a bear skin in order to run around berserk, biting people as if he were a bear. As Eliade summarizes, to behave like a beast of prey, wolf, bear, leopard, betokens that one has ceased to be a man, that one has, in some sort, become a god. On the level of elemental religious experience, the beast of prey represents a higher mode of existence. In some ancient settings, conflicts between humans and predator beasts were staged as almost purely secular events, a form of entertainment. Roman gladiators fought not only other men, but wild animals, and, except when pitted against unarmed victims, such as the early Christians, the animals were usually the losers. The Emperor Augustus boasted of the killing of 3,500 animals during his regime, while the later Emperor Titus supplied 5,000 to be killed in a single day. According to a contemporary observer, should the arena become too sodden with blood, it is raked over, and fresh sand is scattered. One result of this form of entertainment was that the most skillful animal combatants, such as lions, were largely exterminated in many parts of the Roman world. DNA, and bedtime stories. Obviously, the human fascination with the drama of predation has survived much longer than the kinds of situations which originally inspired it. If we were to guess, somewhat arbitrarily, that the human prey-to-predator transformation was more or less complete only as recently as 25,000 years ago, a time of big game hunting and, at least in the European archaeological record, self-confident artistic production, then we must still account for the continuing human preoccupation with this transformation for another 1,000 generations. Even if we take as our starting point the far more recent rise of settled agricultural communities, which would have seen wild carnivores as a threat primarily to livestock, many generations intervene between the terrifying actuality and its encryption in familiar myths. How are we to explain the compulsive repetition, as noted by Maurice Bloch, of rituals and entertainments recapitulating the terror of predation and the triumph of the prey-to-predator transformation? The easiest, and perhaps the laziest, hypothesis would be that we simply inherit this preoccupation, that much of the emotional response to predation is somehow hardwired into the circuitry of the human brain. We know, from very recent research, that other species retain responses and abilities apparently derived from encounters with long-extinct predators. California ground squirrels, for example, are still capable of stereotypic anti-rattlesnake behavior, throwing dirt and fluffing up their tails, although they have been rattlesnake-free for 70,000 to 300,000 years. North American pronghorn antelopes can achieve speeds of about 60 miles per hour, although any local predators capable of outrunning them have been extinct for at least 10,000 years. Could it be that humans are similarly haunted by the ghosts of predators past? Darwin pondered the question when his 2-year-old son developed a fear of large caged animals at the zoo. Might we not suspect, the great amateur biologist wondered, that the fears of children, which are quite independent of experience, are the inherited effects of real dangers during savage times? I hesitate to even raise this possibility, knowing that genetic explanations of human behavior are controversial, for reasons quite apart from their potential scientific validity. At the present time, scholarly opinion is sharply divided on the role of heredity, and even of biology generally, in framing human behavior and personality. The more biologically inclined seek genetic explanations for almost every aspect of human personality, and make a case for specific genes for such seemingly complex traits as intelligence, risk-taking, and homosexuality. The more culturally inclined, on the other hand, tend to see each new generation as a tabula rasa, waiting to be filled in with notions socially constructed by its particular culture. Loosely put, nurture has been the rallying cry of the scholarly left, because it seems to maximize human options, while nature has tended to be the province of the scholarly right, because it has so often been deployed to ratify the social status quo. What better way to argue that things cannot change than to claim that they are the way they are, because this is what nature has decreed? As sensible people have repeatedly pointed out, this is hardly an either-or proposition. Whatever we may inherit by way of behavioral propensities or just that, propensities, which may or may not be expressed as actual behavior, depending on whether the environment calls them forth. A gene for alcoholism, for example, will do little damage in a culture innocent of the technology of fermentation, or in an individual, a nun, for example, committed to abstinence. We inherit only certain potential responses, and it is up to our environment to evoke or suppress them. But those who value human freedom have little to fear from genetic types of explanations anyway. Even in an environment favorable to their expression, the existence of inherited predispositions does not condemn us to enact them. If it could be shown, for example, that humans have an innate taste for male domination, or for bloodshed, or any other form of nastiness. We could seek to order our social arrangements so as to counter this tendency. The biologist Richard Dawkins, who has been much maligned in certain circles for his alleged overemphasis on the role of genetics, assures us that it is perfectly possible to hold that genes exert a statistical influence on human behavior, while at the same time believing that this influence can be modified, overridden, or reversed by other influences. To offer a medical analogy, just because a disease is genetic, like Tay-Sachs or Huntington's disease, we are not absolved from the obligation to cure it. In fact, it is the failure to acknowledge an inborn tendency, like the failure to reckon with the subconscious urge, that inexorably condemns us to live it out. Furthermore, the fact that some response or pattern of behavior may be entirely culturally determined hardly means that each generation is free to alter it at will. Just as biology is not a dictatorship, at least when it comes to human behavior, neither is culture a realm of freedom. If we decide that something like war, for example, is an artifact of culture rather than the imperative of, say, a genetically determined killer instinct, then we are acknowledging that culture is at least as full of hideous snares as the human genome may be. The question, though, is not whether a genetic hypothesis is politically congenial, but whether it is true. How would we determine the ways in which the experience of predation may have, through millennia of natural selection, left its mark on our neuronal circuitry? What responses to what images or situations would we look for? Could these responses be humanely sought in experiments with infants? Could we find variations in these responses from one individual to another, and evidence of familial transmission among individuals? If so, could we rule out non-genetic mechanisms for such transmission? Chronic anxiety, for example, could easily be transmitted from one generation to the next by other than genetic means. The data we have now, however, is enough to establish that the human brain contains at least some innate residue of the experience of predation. The fight-or-flight response is the most obvious example, but more lasting states of mind have also been traced, at least speculatively, to the evolutionary experience of predation. In neurobiological terms, anxiety is a close relative of panic, and akin to the constant vigilance displayed in the wild by animals, which are at risk of predation. Just as panic is a response to an imminent attack, generalized anxiety may well be a response to an environment in which attacks can be expected to occur. Psychiatrists Isaac Marks and Randolph Ness argue that panic disorders, phobias, and chronic anxiety all represent evolutionary adaptations to a dangerous environment, replete with predators and non-living threats such as lightning and heights. Interestingly, some of the same drugs, fluoxetine or Prozac, for example, which are used to treat anxiety in humans, have the effect of rendering mice dangerously nonchalant in the face of a traditional predator, the rat. The likelihood that states of chronic anxiety reflect the evolutionary experience of predation does not, by itself, explain the continuing prominence of predation in rituals practiced long after wild animals had ceased to be a common threat. Why should the anxiety continue to focus on the specific fear of being devoured? The available studies suggest that humans and other primates are not born with the fear of their natural predators, or even of the most ancient antagonists known to mammals, snakes and other reptiles. So it is hard to imagine a purely genetic explanation for the prominence of animal predation in cultural rituals and myth. There is, however, experimental evidence that human subjects can much more readily develop phobic reactions to so-called archaic threats, such as snakes, than to modern ones, such as cars and guns. Unfortunately, The only archaic threats that seem to have been studied are snakes and spiders, rather than, say, lions and leopards. These creatures, though, elicited phobic reactions more readily than did other environmental cues, and the reactions they elicited were more lasting and slower to fade. What we seem to inherit, then, is not a fear of specific predators, but a capacity to acquire that fear, for example, by observing the reaction of adults to various potential threats, with efficiency and tenacity. Hence, perhaps, the surprising frequency of predator animals in dreams, as mentioned earlier. So we can say, without, I hope, offending the social constructionists, that human beings inherit certain patterned responses to threats, and that the threat, which originally selected for these responses, was probably that of predation. It seems likely, then, that the primordial experience of predation at least colors our emotional responses to situations other than predation itself. The sight of violence or bloodshed occasioned by our fellow humans, for example. This does not mean that we remember, in any Jungian or mystical sense, the alarm felt by our distant ancestors when a leopard pounced on one of their comrades and began to rip him apart. Only that there was an evolutionary advantage to the ability to feel this alarm, and that this ability has been passed along to us. We who live now are the descendants of those early humans who reacted strongly and quickly to the sight of violence, whether by fleeing or banding together defensively. Those who failed to react would have left far fewer descendants. Thus, even in our relatively predator-free modern environment, the sight of bloodshed can trigger the fight-or-flight response, or at least a mild version of it. Our hearts beat faster. We breathe more rapidly. Our skin may blanch and viscera contract. We pay attention. But if biology left us with the capacity for powerful physiological response to predation, it is culture which continued to activate this capacity long after the actual threat had vanished or declined. One can easily imagine how highly specific predator-related fears might be transmitted by entirely cultural mechanisms from one generation to the next. Initiation rites, such as those of the Orokaiva and so many other cultures, in which children are terrorized by mimed threats of predation, can be seen as sources, as well as reflections of predator-related anxieties. In addition, children in many cultures are warned that monsters, boogeymen, or wild carnivores will get them if they fail to obey their elders. At least in the Northern European tradition, children's stories routinely feature devouring beasts and cannibals. Babies even look like prey to grown-ups. We tell them, lovingly, they are so cute that we could eat them up. An urban myth which, as a nervous first-time mother, I encountered in wildly different ethnic settings, has the parents returning home to find that the babysitter has roasted their infant in the oven, like a turkey. The fact that most cultures entrust the care of small children almost entirely to women might also favor the cultural transmission of predator-related anxieties. To the extent that women have been barred from the use of effective weapons, even in predator-infested locales, and to the extent that male domination takes on the symbolic coloration of predator-prey interactions, women might be expected to be especially fearful of the possibility of predation, and likely to communicate their fears to children. Among the Inuit, for example, women were taught from an early age to fear the bear. Many stories told how women were attacked, mutilated, and devoured by hungry bears that unexpectedly appeared in camp when the men were away hunting, or which intercepted solitary and defenseless women along the paths. The anthropologist does not comment on whether this fear was rational in terms of the likelihood of an actual bear attack, or whether it simply reflected women's subordinate status in a culture where, as he relates, the bear is an important symbol of masculine power and sexual potency. Either way, women's relative defenselessness would probably be communicated to children as a predator-related fear. And from a mother's point of view, it is far safer for the children to fear too much or to fear unlikely threats than to fear too little. Could the practice of scaring children with threats and stories of predator beasts account for the continuing human anxiety about predation, even in locales like New Guinea and Australia, where there have been no terrestrial predators to worry about for thousands of years? The literature I have found has little to say on this point. We do know, however, that fears implanted in early childhood are far more intense and irrational than those acquired later on, and hence could conceivably be transmitted through many generations in a fairly specific form. Such fears, Dawkins suggests, are self-perpetuating because of their deep psychological impact on each generation in turn. If a woman feared lions and communicated this fear urgently enough to her daughters, the fear might persist in her grandchildren long after all the lions had been driven away. The widespread human disgust for feces may be similarly transmitted. Humans are not born with this sensitivity. In fact, babies have been known to play with or even eat their feces. But it seems to be communicated to them readily enough. The fact that a trait so essential for disease avoidance can be entrusted to nurture rather than nature suggests that cultural forms of transmission can be highly reliable indeed, and over many generations. But the cultural transmission of predator-related anxiety from parent to child would not work without another biological given: the prolonged helplessness of human young. Children are susceptible to fears implanted by their elders, not only because of their ignorance and inexperience, but because of their actual vulnerability. Even a friendly terrier looks very different from a height of 2 feet than from an adult's 5 feet or more. And adults are tempted to instill such fears, not only because they may be insensitive or irrationally driven to replicate the traumas they themselves experienced as children, but because fear helps children to survive. However, this anxiety is transmitted from generation to generation, through cultural practices, biological inheritance, or more likely, a mixture of both. Cultures address it in many ingenious ways. There are blood rites, as we have seen, that mime predation, and blood sports, such as the Roman games that acted out. In our own time, the spectacle of anti-human violence is replayed endlessly by a commercial entertainment industry which thrives on people's willingness to pay for the frisson inspired by images of their fellow humans being stalked by killers, sucked dry by vampires, or devoured by multi-mouthed beasts from outer space. There is even a vogue of what could be called predation porn. Depictions on the Discovery Channel, for example, of actual predators in acts of actual predation. An hour-long show on the Fox Channel, When Animals Attack, offers tapes and reenactments of recent incidents in which humans were attacked by bears, mountain lions, or other wild predators. All such spectacles and rites offer a safe version of the trauma of predation, one in which we approach the nightmare and survive. Though, fortunately for the purveyors of such entertainments, the very spectacles that safely scare us probably help perpetuate the anxiety that drives us to them. In addition to such safe reenactments, humans have another way of addressing their predation-related anxieties, and this is through the thrill of defensive solidarity. The crowd that gathers to stone the scapegoat chosen as a sacrifice, or that cheers the gladiators in the arena, experiences a burst of fear-dissolving strength. It is through collective effort that our distant ancestors defeated the beast that was the ancestor of our fears, and we still seek the kind of elan that our ancestors found in that archaic confrontation. Give us an enemy, and a team or tribe with which to face that enemy down, and all anxiety dissolves temporarily, in a surge of collective aggression against the threat. The capacity for defensive solidarity is, I would suggest, another legacy of the prehistoric war against animal predators. This does not mean we are programmed to band together and fight, any more than we are programmed to turn tail and flee. But obviously, we possess both the capacity for collective action and the capacity to be rewarded for such action with pleasurable feelings of potency. The most likely source of these capacities was the experience of predation, which may have given a selective advantage to those individuals who rallied to the group's defense and, in doing so, saved the lives of their children or grandchildren. We are wired, in a sense, for solidarity, although clearly this is a neurobiological possibility that many of us, in a highly individualistic and competitive culture, manage to repress or ignore for months or years at a time. Thus, there are two likely psychological legacies of predation, which would appear to be relevant to the institution of war. One is the automatic response of alarm in the face of a threat, or of anxiety in a continuously threatening environment, which we inherit from a time when our ancestors faced the world largely as prey. Designed to ready us physiologically to fight or flee a dangerous animal, this response is what makes war, or any other spectacle of carnage, so gripping to us. In historical times, people stayed up late, night after night, to hear the epics and chansons of war retold. In our own time, the threat of war can keep us glued to the television set, as Americans were during the build-up to the Gulf War in 1990 and 91. The other, apparently weaker response, readies us emotionally for collective action and possible self-sacrifice for the sake of the group. Many culturally contrived events, from sacred rituals to televised team sports, allow us to recapture the elemental potency of the group, united against the beast. But few do so more reliably than war, if only because in war, as opposed to, say, soccer, the threat of death is real. Neither of these responses is the cause of war. They are simply part of the repertory of emotional responses we bring to war, no matter what happens to have caused it. But it is these responses, I am suggesting, that color war with the profound feelings, dread, awe, and the willingness to sacrifice that make it sacred to us. The alarm response infuses war and stories of war with urgency and excitement, while the solidarity response, if we may call it that, mobilizes our most altruistic and exalted impulses. And these are the very feelings which give us some purchase on our notions of a mystic entity, a nation, or an all-encompassing deity, of which we individuals are only the parts. To put it another way, we will not find the roots of the human attraction to war by searching the human psyche for some innate flaw that condemns us to harass and kill our fellows. In war, we act as if the only enemies we have are human ones. But I am proposing that the emotions we bring to war are derived, in an evolutionary sense, from a primal battle that the entire human species might easily have lost. We are not alone on this planet, and we were once decisively outnumbered by creatures far stronger and more vicious than ourselves. Medicine offers a useful analogy. In an autoimmune disease, the body's immunological defenses turn against the body itself. Cellular responses, which evolved to combat invading microorganisms, start combating, instead, the tissues of heart or muscle. We do not understand exactly why, in all cases, the immune mechanism becomes so confused that it can no longer distinguish self from other. But we could not even begin to comprehend these perverse ills if we had no inkling of humankind's long struggle against an external enemy, the viruses, bacteria, and parasites that cause so many diseases. Because it was out of that struggle that the immune system evolved in the first place. Similarly, with war. The weapons have changed beyond recognition over the millennia, but the basic emotional responses represent defensive mechanisms which evolved in combat with a deadly, non-human, other. 6. When the predator had a woman's face. The great goddess everywhere demands sacrifices, because the decisive moments in the life of the female, menstruation, deflowering, conception, and childbearing, are intimately bound up with a sacrifice of blood. Eric Neumann. Some of the earliest deities worshipped by humans were female, but they were hardly the nurturing earth mothers imagined by so many later scholars, both male and female. The archaic goddess unearthed from Mediterranean and Mesopotamian ruins, or recalled in Mesoamerican mythology, is far more likely to hold a snake in her clenched fist than a child in her arms. Only rarely a mother, and seldom a wife, she reigned in the company of her lion, serpent, or leopard familiars. She was a huntress, a consumer of sacrificial offerings, and most strikingly, an anthropomorphized version of the predator beast. In Anatolia, the predator goddess is Cybele, the commander of lions. In Egypt, she is Sekhmet, portrayed as a lioness whose mane smoked with fire. Her back had the color of blood. Her countenance glowed like the sun. Her eyes shone with fire. In India, she is Durga, also known as Kali, who rides on a tiger and is associated, in Brahmanic texts, with an actual forest region infested with lions and tigers. In Sumer, she is Inanna, one of whose names was Labatu, or lioness, and who is often shown standing with her feet planted on the backs of two imperious lions. In Canaan, she is Astarte, who is depicted similarly on a lion's back. In Mycenae, she is flanked by lions. At Çatalhöyük, she sits between leopards. In Crete, she is shown playing with lions or standing on a lion-flanked mountain before a worshipping youth. In the Homeric epic, she is Artemis, of whom the poet says, "Zeus has made you a lion among women, and given you leave to kill any at your pleasure." We do not know what, if anything, these fierce goddesses have to tell us about the status of actual women in the cultures that worship them. But our concern here is with human attitudes toward violence. And it is striking that images associated with bloodshed and predation could once have been gendered in a way opposite to what we are used to. That there was a time, apparently in many disparate cultures, when imagination gave the beast a human female form. In this chapter, we consider the feminine imagery of the predator beast, as suggested by archaic predator goddesses, and speculate on what it meant and why it eventually faded. The data are scant, and the literature is either frustratingly speculative or tainted with romantic notions of femininity from historical times. But it does seem likely that the ascension of mankind to the status of predator was followed, near to historical times, by the descent of woman in the opposite direction, from someone who could be imagined as possessing lethal force to a creature more commonly conceived as prey. To the Jungian scholar Eric Neumann, who put together an exhaustive survey of the mythology of the Great Mother in the early 1960s, the beasts that accompany the archaic goddess are not her guardians. They are aspects of herself, if not her very essence. The terrible nature of the feminine may take either of two forms. Either the goddess herself may become the terrifying animal, or her terrible aspect may become the animal that accompanies and dominates her. Thus, she may be a lioness, or else she may be enthroned on a lion, or ride on a lion. In India, she may be a tigress, or else she may ride on a tigress or a lioness. As Artemis, she may be a she-bear, or the bear may be her companion animal. Her predatory nature is revealed, in part, by her dominion over the hunt. At least since Sir James George Frazer's The Golden Bough, scholars have tended to associate goddess worship with agriculture, and the goddess with the life-giving earth. But in the religions of the Aztecs, the ancient Greeks, Egyptians, and Sumerians, a female deity presides over the hunt and wild animals in general. The Aztec goddess of the hunt later evolved into an agricultural deity. Nor is her femaleness incidental to her divine identity as the mistress of animals and the hunt. Artemis, like her Sumerian counterpart, Ninhursaga, is goddess not only of the hunt, but of that quintessentially female achievement, childbirth. Artemis presents a particularly baffling persona to those who believe that the moral order was always divided into principles of male violence and female gentleness. Probably far older than the Olympian pantheon of gods and goddesses, and according to Burkert, even Paleolithic in provenance, Artemis was originally a bear, or in more southerly localities, a lioness. Her association with the moon and wild animals links her to the archaic Cretan, Lady of the Wild Things. Dudley Young observes that her necklace of bull scrotums is usually registered by polite scholars as extra dogs, and the Olympians tried to make her somewhat decent and respectable by casting her as Apollo's sister, her moon, to his son. But with only moderate success, she remains formidably frightening. When a human hunter, Actaeon, happened to see her naked, bathing, Artemis transformed him into a stag and had him torn to bits by his own hounds. As Burkert tells us, she was exacting in her demands for cruel and bloody sacrifices. It is not only as a huntress that early goddesses revealed a predatory, even bestial side. They were carnivorous and often displayed a special appetite for the bodies and blood of living creatures. An Egyptian document from about 2000 BC tells of Sekhmet's efforts to slaughter the entire human race, a project from which she was distracted by being given 7,000 jars of beer dyed the color of blood. The Erinyes, or Furies, thonic mother goddesses of ancient Greece, were also huntresses, but non-human ones, often described as serpents or bitches. Aeschylus has Apollo tell them, disgustedly, "You should make your dwelling the cave of some blood-gorged lion." Tanit, also known as Astarte, who has been described by contemporary goddess enthusiasts as a goddess of fertility and of everything that governed the generation of life, was, along with her male consort, the recipient of child sacrifices at Carthage. But for bloodthirstiness, no known or remembered goddess surpasses Kali, who, according to historian D.D. Kusambi, descends from pre-agricultural religious traditions predating the Aryan invasion of the Indian subcontinent. In the Devi Mahatima, circa AD 550, Kali is depicted wearing a necklace of skulls and a tiger skin. Hungry-looking, emaciated, wild-mouthed with lolling tongue and sunken reddish eyes, she was capable of devouring whole armies, elephants and chariots included. No doubt the dark side of the goddess was exaggerated by later adherents of patriarchal religions, just as the wise woman of pre-Christian European tradition was discredited by the late medieval church as a witch. But there is reason to think that the real goddess, as known to her original worshippers, deserved at least some of her later reputation for bloodthirstiness. The symbol of the Cretan goddess, also associated with the supreme Sumerian goddess Inanna, was the labrus, or sacred double axe, probably representing the axe with which sacrificial animals were killed. In historical times, Kali has been particularly demanding of blood sacrifices, including the human blood offered by frenzied, self-mutilating cult worshippers. Or consider the bloody Great Mother cult that spread to Greece from Anatolia, beginning in about 700 BC, probably basing itself on far more ancient Mycenaean and Cretan traditions of goddess worship. Burkert reports that the Great Mother's priests, or Gali, were forbidden to eat anything but meat, as befits admirers of a carnivorous deity, and that the main spectacle of the meat-eater cult, as also of some related Anatolian cults, was the Day of Blood, when the Gali would flagellate themselves in public and cut their arms with knives and axes till they streamed with blood, without showing any sign of pain. If there has been consistent misrepresentation of the archaic goddess, it has been in the direction of downplaying her more savage predilections. By classical times, and certainly in our own time, the associations between masculinity and violence, femininity and nonviolence, had hardened into dogma. The primordial goddess, huntress of beasts and consumer of blood, had to be prettified as a seductress, like Aphrodite, or a motherly figure with a passion for gardening, like Demeter or Ceres. In the tantric philosophical tradition, Kali underwent a cosmetic makeover into a benign, if still somewhat bloody-minded, lady. Her face is sometimes described as beautiful and smiling, her breasts high and youthful, her gauntness gone. Two of her hands still hold the severed head and bloody cleaver, but her other two form the gestures of blessing, removing fear, and conferring boons. Ironically, contemporary feminist scholars have been particularly energetic in their efforts to rehabilitate the archaic goddess as a thoroughly gentle and feminine figure. The archaeologist Maria Gimbutas consistently slighted the goddess's violent side, even conjecturing wistfully that the Minoan and Sumerian goddesses' double axe symbolized a butterfly. Similarly, in her provocative work on the rise of male dominance, Rhianne Eisler asserts that in archaic goddess-centered cultures, the generative, nurturing, and creative powers of nature, not the powers to destroy, were given highest value. How then to explain the goddess's preference for the company of leopards and bulls? These, Eisler says, represented our forebears' attempt to deal with the darker aspects of reality and to show, with admirable even-handedness, that the destructive processes of nature were also recognized and respected. Gender biases are revealed, too, in the scholarly bafflement over the goddess's enthusiasm for the hunt and her apparently pre-agricultural origins. The earliest alleged representations of a female deity are the Paleolithic Venus figurines found on the Eurasian landmass from Western Europe to Siberia, and dating back to almost 30,000 years ago, or roughly 20,000 years before the coming of agriculture. Another example of gender bias is the widespread assumption, repeated by Gimbutas, that the Paleolithic Venuses, which presumably prefigure the archaic goddess, were fertility figures. It's true that many of the Venus figurines have exaggerated breasts, bellies, and buttocks, but they are not all visibly pregnant, and some of those that appear to be so may simply be fat. Furthermore, Paleolithic images of males, including cave drawings of stick figures sporting exaggerated erections, are never interpreted as fertility figures. Nor is there any reason to believe that Paleolithic hunter-gatherers were particularly anxious about fertility. Among hunter-gatherers, especially nomadic ones, high fertility can be a distinct disadvantage, and extended lactation is employed to space births. But compared to agriculture, hunting is a violent and, hence, according to modern notions of gender, presumably masculine enterprise. Thus, to Gimbutas, the great antiquity of the goddess, or her probable forebears, seemed to defy logic. It would seem logical, to look for the origin of the Earth fertility goddess at the dawn of agriculture. However, the pregnant type figurine first appears not in the early Neolithic, but earlier still, in the Paleolithic. The symbol of the fruitful womb is as old as figurine art. Even as careful a historian as Gerda Lerner states erroneously that it is from the Neolithic that we derive surviving evidence of cave paintings and sculptures, suggesting the pervasive veneration of the mother goddess, when it is, in fact, from the Paleolithic. In the logic of our own time, violence is an exclusively male attribute, so that the notion of a predator goddess can only be a cultural oxymoron. Predation and the semiotics of menstruation. One possible explanation for the seeming anomaly of a predator goddess is that she represents a vestige of what was once an actual female economic role. Among surviving hunting-gathering cultures, as well as those encountered by Europeans in the past few centuries, hunting is an almost exclusively male enterprise. But contemporary hunter-gatherers inhabit a world sadly depleted of the large ungulates on which our prehistoric ancestors dined. Hunting today is largely a matter of searching, tracking, and waiting, and is generally undertaken by small groups of men at considerable distances from their homes. In the context of far denser animal populations, when vast herds darken the plains and threaten human bands with being trampled underfoot, hunting may more nearly have resembled herding, and very likely involved all the members of a band. Possibly Paleolithic women participated in drives of big game animals, just as Amerindian women did before the horse transformed bison hunting into a strictly male enterprise. Anthropologist Marvin Harris writes that since the Paleolithic hunter-gatherers appear to have hunted big game herd animals, mainly by driving them into pitfalls, over cliffs, and into bogs, women would be important at least as drivers and beaters, and would render valuable service as butchers and bearers once the wounded animals had been dispatched. Nor is there any reason to suppose that women did not carry spears and participate in the actual killing of the trapped animals. But it is also possible that the link between the predator beast and the human female reflects something even more basic, in a biological sense, than the killing of animals for food. The connection may lie in a phenomenon which is not unique to humans, but is uniquely dramatic in its human form. Human females bleed, regularly, and in amounts that are profligate compared with other primate species. They bleed at the reproductive turning points of their lives, menarche, defloration, childbirth, and at more or less regular intervals in between. To a person of our own era, female vaginal bleeding is an event of almost zero public import. We see it as a sickness, at best an inconvenience, and usually, thanks to sanitary napkins and tampons, we do not see it at all. But there are reasons, admittedly of a purely a priori variety, to think that menstruation may have figured far more prominently in the lives of Paleolithic people than it does in our own. Humans menstruate more copiously than any other mammals, and before the invention of paper and cloth, it would have been difficult to conceal the flow, especially among groups whose nomadic lifestyle prevented menstruating women from secluding themselves and squatting for days over the absorbent ground. Heightening the potential drama of menstruation is the tendency for human females spontaneously to synchronize their periods. This tendency is known to occur among women living together today, such as female students in dormitories, and has been well documented in the medical literature. Whether it occurs among existing hunter-gatherers has apparently not been investigated, though the British anthropologist Chris Knight points out that the Kung people of the Kalahari Desert believe that if a woman sees traces of menstrual blood on another woman's leg, or even is told that another woman has started her period, she will begin menstruating as well. Then there is the fact that the periodicity of human menstruation so closely matches the cycle of the moon. For people whose powers of illumination were limited to campfires, the lunar cycle would have been of commanding importance. The sun comes and goes on a reliable 24-hour schedule. The moon, however, vanishes completely for 3 nights out of the month, nights that would have been terrifyingly, impenetrably dark. For another 3 or 4 nights of the month, the full or gibbous moon lights up the nighttime world, making it safer, more friendly to humans, and perhaps allowing daytime activities like hunting and gathering to continue after hours. Given the likely centrality of the moon in the lives of prehistoric people, it is not surprising that the archaic goddess from Mesoamerica to the Mediterranean was a goddess of the moon. Add to this the fact that, as far as we know, prehistoric people were fairly obsessed with the business of tracking and predicting astronomical events. The linear markings found etched by Paleolithic humans on so many animal tusks and bones have been interpreted as records of the lunar cycle. They might equally well be records of women's menstrual cycles. It is hard to distinguish the astronomical from the menstrual in the human case. Of all the primates, humans have a menstrual cycle that comes closest to matching the 29.5-day cycle of the moon. Even today, this coincidence between the menstrual and the astral goes begging for a theory to explain it. We know enough now to describe the hormonal cycle that underlies menstrual bleeding. We can plot the orbit of the moon. But we have no explanation for the connection between the two cycles. To people who lacked even the concept of a scientific explanation, it may have seemed that women's cycles controlled the moon, or else that the divine presence, that is the moon, expresses itself through the bodies of human females. How prehistoric people construed this remarkable conjecture, we do not, and probably cannot, know. It does seem likely, though, that the synchronization of menstruation among women and its further synchronization with the lunar cycle could have sufficed to make menstruation an event of some public significance, if not an occasion for ritual observance. But menstruation is not just any cyclical occurrence. It involves the shedding of blood, which is itself a dire event, with or without group synchrony and astral coincidences, and at least intuitively associated with acts of deliberate bloodshed. Aristotle observed in the Historia Animalium that menstrual blood runs like that of an animal that has just been stabbed in sacrifice. And Hippocratic medical texts utilized the same analogy. Or the blood may be interpreted as symbolizing violence committed by the woman herself, as British anthropologist Kamita Power reports of contemporary African hunter-gatherer societies. Of the Kung girl, upon her first menstruation, people say, "She has shot an eland." A similar metaphor is used by the Hadza for menarche. "She has shot her first zebra." Among the Go, this is ritually enacted. On the final day of seclusion, a Gemsbok brow skin shield is hung at the back of the menstrual hut, and the maiden is helped by the mistress of ceremonies to shoot arrows against it. Some cultures make a conscious and explicit connection between women's natural vaginal bleeding, both menstrual and postpartum, and acts of ritual bloodletting, usually reserved for males. In Papua New Guinea, the self-induced ritual nosebleeds mentioned earlier are seen as parallel to menstruation. The Australian Aborigines who sub-incise their penises reopen the wounds regularly in order, they say, to simulate menstruation. In ancient Hawaii, blood sacrifice was understood to be a man's childbearing, just as childbearing was a woman's sacrifice. And the Aztecs similarly equated men's death in war to women's death in childbirth. War, as a kind of ritual bloodletting, is linked to menstruation in the myths of the Ndembu people of Africa. And Ndembu male initiates are implicitly treated like brides at their first menstruation. In the Plains Indian mythology studied by Claude Levi-Strauss, there is a link between the menstruating women, i.e. stained with blood below, and the scalped man, i.e. stained with blood above. This equivalence is no mere postulation, he reports. It is clearly stated in the myths themselves, which bring together, in the same story, the origin of scalping and that of menstruation, or make menstruation responsible for the first trophy head. But the spectacle of menstruation also hints, disquietingly, at the danger of predation by creatures other than human. An interesting question is whether menstruation renders women more vulnerable to predator attacks. Bears seem to be attracted to menstrual blood, though it is not clear whether they are more attracted to it than to ordinary blood. But surely, as any contemporary hiker knows, it would be unwise to leave a trail of blood, menstrual or otherwise, behind one in the wilderness, if only because it would seem to signal the presence of someone who is injured, and hence vulnerable to attack. Margie Proffitt, the biologist who has proposed that the evolutionary function of menstruation was to flush out pathogens from the vagina, had not thought about this biological downside of menstruation when I interviewed her by phone in 1995. However, Judy Grand speculates that the most widespread menstrual ritual observed by a